Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Come with us as we discover what makes people killers, what makes people victims, and what happens next.
James Phelps is an Australian journalist and the author of Australia's Hardest Prison, Inside the Walls of Long Bay Jail, Australia's Most Murderous Prison, Inside Goulburn Jail, Green is the New Black, Inside Australia's Hardest Women's Jails, and Australia's Toughest Prison Inmates. Michelle, you spoke to James about his prison obsession and you got an insight into the life of a certain former Australian TV star turned convicted sex offender.
I did, and it's safe to say Hey Dad's Robert Hughes isn't the most popular bloke around the exercise yard at Goulburn Prison. I also had the opportunity to speak to a former inmate about, among other things, how much stuff he can fit inside his own bum, which you have always wondered about, Emily, I know.
Yes, it's been keeping me up at night.
It's been keeping us all up at night. That's coming up. But first, author James Phelps and the fearsome Goulburn Prison.
Yeah, the Aryan Brotherhood's actually the biggest gang in the world, believe it or not.
Wow.
And they outrate the Crips and the Bloods and all these other gangs in America. And they've got 40% of the prison population in America is Aryan Brotherhood. So, yeah, it's not like that over here, certainly. The Anglos are in the minority and at Goulburn, certainly the biggest groups were the Indigenous Aboriginals and the Lebanese, and they bond together. They're in yards next to each other in a racially segregated area.
Mm.
And, they're actually the Aboriginal Indigenous guys put on one of the biggest riots in history back in 2001, and it left a prison officer in hospital in a coma for 2 or 3 months and in hospital getting rehabilitation for a year. And this poor guy, Tim Swain is his name, he's living in assisted care now. He's a shadow of the guy he used to be.
Yeah, he's featured in your book. Can you tell us a bit more about him? What sort of bloke was he before the riot?
Yeah, look, I went down and met him. I actually took me a long time for him to agree to talk to me because he's still not in a great way. He has to have his mail read to him. He can't do everyday duties. He can make himself a cup of coffee now, which he was quite proud of. But I met his ex-wife, who was about to be married. Mm. Sorry, no, they were engaged at the time, sorry, and they just bought a house, and she helped me out. But we went there, and apparently he was an athlete. He was doing the Goulburn to Canberra bike ride. He was involved in triathlon. He was very fit. He was a good-looking bloke who apparently had 5 or 6 women chasing after him. But he'd just gotten engaged, and he was saving up for his wedding and honeymoon. They just moved into a new house, and on this day he went to work and it just all broke loose. And
well, he wasn't supposed to be at work, was he? He'd taken an overtime shift. In fact, all 4 guards in that wing in that moment were not meant to be there.
Yeah, see, one was an older bloke, a veteran, there was another female, and then there was a really young bloke that Tim said, wasn't interested in the job, didn't like it much. But yeah, they were up in the watchtower, and then they little sort of caged area, and they were watching them all go in, and all of a sudden, they saw people making their way to the woman who was in the other end of the wing at the cage, the woman guard. And Tim and this guy said, look, we've got to go. Something's going to happen. And as they were on their way there, they got jumped from a cell. Mm. And Tim ended up getting hit with a didgeridoo, among other things, stomped, punched. And he doesn't remember any of it, obviously. But the people that saw it, the guards had to rush in. It was a full-scale riot. They destroyed everything within the cell. You're talking desks. They had sawn off posts off their bed to use as poles.
Mm.
They burnt whatever they could find. And anyway, he was rushed to hospital and put on life support. And they actually asked the family and the father if they should turn the machine off because they said that he probably wouldn't pull through. And if he did, he was going to be incapacitated and possibly a vegetable. So,
and meanwhile, his fiancée also worked at Goulburn, and she was one of the responding officers who ran in there to try and stop the riot. So she was well aware that her partner had been badly injured.
Yeah, she actually, as she was running in, she saw the guards being rolled out on the stretchers and into the ambulance, and she immediately knew it was Tim. She said it was just like a feeling she had that she knew it was him. And it was funny. She carried on with her job. She was absolutely professional. She was instrumental in shutting the riot down. And then when she sort of finished and came back and took her riot gear off, they said, you better come with us. And so Supermax is a jail within a jail. So that's a facility within Goulburn. What happening here, this was actually in the Indigenous wing, a maximum security wing, no less, but it's not quite as locked down as Supermax.
Right.
But, yeah, they were making their way up.
But they had the facilities. They had the facilities to get in there and lock themselves in. And, in fact, Tim and the other young guy he was with, they did manage it. They got themselves locked into their cage and then had to unlock it and walk out into the melee to try and assist the other officers.
Yeah, that's right. So,
I mean, you think you've covered all your bases, but then...
They work every day with these people, and you can't expect things like this just to tee off. I mean, they were walking past these murderers and rapists every minute, speaking to them, putting them in their cells.
But I suppose the difference is the prisoners have all day to think this stuff up.
Oh, they do. They have all the time in the world, and especially in some circumstances where in Supermax they spend 23 hours a day locked in their cell and they're let out for an hour a day if they've earned the privilege.
Yeah. You detailed the book. I mean, how I came across this book, and a lot of Australians would have, was the other day they printed an excerpt in the paper in which you discuss specifically Robert Hughes, the Hey Dad actor, and his first moments in Goulburn Jail, and that's how you open the book as well. And it's a great way to try and get your head around the process from a person who's never been in jail before and then finds themselves in this kind of environment. Can you talk us through that, please?
Yeah, everyone thinks that what you see in movies is untrue, but what I've learnt doing these prison books is everything you see in the movies is real and then some. And I think this story demonstrated that, because I'm sure you haven't seen this in Shawshank Redemption or Escape for Alcatraz, but Robert Hughes was convicted of child sex offences, and that puts him in the lowest form of criminal class. And he went there and he's really smug and arrogant, hadn't showed any contrition for his crimes. And then he turned up to Goulburn. That all changed very quickly. So he's gone through a reception, got his clothes, and he's had to be processed through a yard. So he was in protection, which means they won't let the other inmates near him because they'd kill him on sight. But what he had to do here was walk across a yard that was lined with two other yards, but split apart by cyclone fences. And they'd found out that he was coming in at this particular time, so all the inmates were up against the fences on either side of this walkway, and they'd collected their milk cartons that they had for breakfast, little 300ml things that you might have had your move or oak in at some point, and they'd filled them up with feces and urine. So Robert walked, and he could hear everyone yelling out, "Hey, Dad," and he tried to sort of turn around and say, "I can't walk past here," and the guard said, "No, mate, go. You have to. You got to go to the other side of the yard." And anyway, he had a 50-metre walk where they just hurled poo and urine at him and yelled out, "Hey, Dad, cop this," and he was covered in it, covered in filth, and sat on a hill once he got across the yard crying for an hour before they took him in to his cell where he had a shower and cleaned up. And then he rang his partner, and, you know, that was the first time anyone had seen him upset, and he cried and said, "I can't do this." Reality hit him, and that's what he was in for during his stay at Goulburn.
And so now he walks around with a ski jacket on at all times because he knows he's going to be pelted with other people's wee and poo whenever they can. I mean, that's his life.
Yeah, it's pretty opportunistic now. They don't know when they're going to see him, but he does get spat at on spot. That's the biggest thing.
The one thing we do see in The Shawshank Redemption is sexual assault. That's a big part of that film. And is that a reality in prison?
Unfortunately, it is. It doesn't happen to the extent that you see it in movies, but it does happen, and it's one of the most horrible things that happens in there. It's underreported, as you'd probably expect. Like, guys that do get raped don't go and tell authorities. Mm. Number one, they're embarrassed. I mean, it's a horrible thing, and they're ashamed about it. And number two, they're scared for their lives. I mean, you know, they've got to go back to a cell or see these guys. They've warned them. They said, "You tell anyone, we're going to kill you." And the way it's picked up and the way that was described to me in the book was the nurses at the medical centre. There's many, many injuries sustained, and I won't go into the details of what sort of injuries, but you can imagine. And, you know, the guys still won't admit what happens, but they know. And, you know, on occasions there have been ones that have gone ahead and pressed charges, and there have been plenty that have been convicted of sexual assault whilst in prison. You know, I didn't think that these stories actually were true, that things like this happened. Like, you know, Shawshank, they've built this, you know, remarkable tunnel all the way out. Mm. But we had one of those in Parramatta Jail. There was a 180-metre tunnel underneath, and, you know, they were ready to go. They almost got out. It was only a bloke placing a phone call to his mum saying, "I'll see you tomorrow," that happened to be tapped, that got these guys busted at the last minute. But, Yeah, they've had, you know, in jails they've been caught with power tools, hammers, everything, and they use them to dig holes. But it's the violence, I guess, that really is the interesting part, and you know, how these blokes survive in this little microcosm.
Yeah, it is so terrifying. Who are some of the prisoners in Goulburn Jail that we'd have heard of?
You would have heard of Ivan Milat, I am sure. He's probably our most notorious criminal in Australia, and he's a very, very difficult prisoner. So I spoke to some psychs for the book, and you know, they obviously look after the prisoner's mental health, but they told me as soon as he got to Goulburn that in their reports they warned that he'd turned to self-mutilation because he didn't have the outlet to hurt other people. So he's addicted to pain and giving it. So when he couldn't hurt other people, he'd turn to himself, and that ended up proving it correct. In Supermax, as you said, cameras, the most monitored jail, x-rays, he managed to get himself a little razor, and he went to take the top of his finger off, so he sat down in his bed and had a crack at it, but it was no good for the bone. The blade was too blunt, so he found a plastic knife with a serrated edge, and he turned it into a saw, and he managed to saw through the bone, and he whacked it in a little envelope and addressed it to the High Court of Australia and tried to send it out. And, of course, all the mail gets screened, so they found this envelope with blood on it and addressed to the High Court from Ivan Milat. They opened it up, found the finger, and they went in, and Ivan was passed out, blood everywhere on the ground. They picked him up, they took him to hospital, and newspaper reports said that they put the finger on ice and tried to reattach it. Well, I can tell you they didn't. One of the guards just threw it over his shoulder and went, mate, bad luck.
I mean, how do they feel about you writing these stories, by the way, the guards? Because they're very candid in the book. There's details that I think, oh, are you allowed to say that?
Yeah, they're a funny bunch. Like, they love talking off the record and they want their stories out there, but a lot of them are terrified about corrective services. I mean, this is their job, and a lot of them would lose their jobs for revealing things like this. So, you know, in the book, a lot of guards are spoken to on the record. They're former guards, but the best stuff probably comes from the current guards. And, you know, they want it. They're their war stories. They want to tell them. A lot of people in the general public don't know what these guys go through and what they do. And they hate being compared to security guards. They hate being called prison guards, even though I've done it in the book.
Oh, okay. What do they want to be called?
Corrections officers.
Okay.
And I mean, they feel that it's a bit degrading and it compares them to a security guard. And, you know, they're probably right, because these guys aren't security guards. They deal with things like Ivan Milat chopping his finger off, and they escort, you know, Basim Hamzi around, and sort of all these dangerous, most dangerous guys.
Who's that guy?
Basim Hamzi. Yeah, he's Brothers for Life. He founded one of the most brutal gangs in Australian history. Oh. There was a shootout at Melbourne. He's actually a Sydney criminal, but someone in Melbourne, I think, owed him $100. For drugs, and he actually caught a plane down and got his gang, six or seven of them, and just peppered the house with bullets. I mean, that's how ruthless this guy is.
Yeah,
but
right.
He's been caught with mobile phones in jail where he's ordering hits.
And actually, isn't there a rival gang leader in there as well of his?
Yeah, he
is. Like an enemy of his?
He can't reveal his name right now because he's in front of the courts. But, it's a rival gang. It's quite brutal. They're responsible for a number of robberies across Sydney, and they don't get on at all.
So how do they keep them apart, and I mean, how do they manage that?
Well, in Supermax, you can actually see nobody if that's what your arrangement is. It's a level of privilege, and you earn the right to do things. So at the very bottom of the chain, you sit in a cell that has nothing except for a bed and a toilet, and you're locked in there for 23 hours a day. Your meals are delivered to you, and you're let out an hour a day for exercise.
And is that individually, like one guy at a time?
Individually, yeah. That's it. So you don't see anyone, your food's brought to you, and you walk out in the yard by yourself. You're let out on your own. And it's a little tiny yard in the middle with a running track and, you know, a basketball hoop. At the other end of the scale, if you're so well-behaved in Supermax, you can actually earn yourself a television. You've got a little kitchenette outside the cell that you'll have access to, and they might give you a toaster and your own bread and some milk, a radio. You'll get some newspapers. And you can also apply for associations. So you might have a mate or someone that you want to talk to in Supermax, and you can apply and say, I want to speak to Joe Bob, and they'll put you in the little kitchenette for an hour together a day. Oh. But that is also open to abuse, because the only time these inmates really apply for associations is when they want to belt the crap out of the other bloke.
Yep. Wow. A lot of murders happen in the shower though, right?
Yeah, there are. A famous one, which was actually kicked off the killing field, was a guy called Marsland. He's a big Indigenous pedophile, and for some reason he was attacked, and it's believed that he raped someone in another jail, and this was payback for that rape.
Oh, my God.
But, he was mobbed by up to three guys while he was in the shower. And there was something like 60-odd stab wounds. It was that bad. But he's run out of the shower, and I've interviewed the guard on the record that was first on the scene, and it's just horrible, chilling stuff. But he describes sticking his fingers into the stab wounds, trying to stop the bleeding as this bloke's dying on the...
That's right. I remember that story. And then he found out the guy had full-blown AIDS.
He did. So this prison guard spent 3 months just having nightmares that he had AIDS. He was sure he had it, given that much blood had gone over him. He said it was spurting on him.
I was really surprised that he would go to that length, to be honest.
Me too. I mean, they take their duty of care very seriously. Mm. And one of the reasons why they wouldn't have known this Marsland guy as that pedophile. They try and just treat every inmate the same. And they have to, because if they know about their crimes and know that this guy's a renowned pedophile, which they kind of do, but they pretend that they're not, they just can't handle it. They want to kill these blokes. And there's another story in the book about a guard that walked into a famous child murderer's cell, and on the back of his door, he's walking out after just giving him something, or I'm not sure about the circumstances, but it said, "Life is short." He'd written that and put it on the back of his door. And this guard just turned around and thought, "Mate, life is short. It's short for the girl that you killed."
Oh my
he grabbed,
God.
Grabbed him around the throat and started choking him, and he said, "Almost killed him." He said, I just at the last minute, I realised what I was doing and let him go and had to run out. He said, "That's the only time I've snapped in my whole career." He said, "But it easily could have led to me killing him."
I can't imagine anyone not wanting to kill him. What sort of people are prison guards?
It's funny. Yeah, a lot of ex-military. I think. A lot of the guys I spoke to have done some sort of military training. Other people that have been in the police force and gotten out and looking for something a little bit different. But at Goulburn Jail, it's pretty much run by families. So they're all second, third, fourth generation. They're cousins, brothers. It's very much an ancestral jail in that sense.
God, that is fascinating. Have you ever interviewed anyone who has been a prisoner in Goulburn or in Long Bay? Any former prisoners?
There's 6 or 7 that I've interviewed for the book, mostly anonymous, but heaps. And in Long Bay, I interviewed Abbo Henry, who was one of the most infamous Sydney criminals ever. He ran around with a guy called Nettie Smith. I don't know if you know Blue Murder, the series, or the Underbellies. Yeah, he was featured heavily in that. He used to take blokes out of the pub and smash their head over sandstone rocks down in the rocks.
What do they say about rehabilitating back into the outside world after living through something like Goulburn?
Okay, well, the way they say to me, you've got two class of criminals. You've got the psychopaths who are sick in the head. They're the pedophiles, the serial killers, these guys.
Yeah.
And then you've got the career criminal. These are your armed robbers, the people that have maybe murdered because of a drug transaction, or, these are career criminals. So the psychopaths, you can't rehabilitate them. They're just mad. You'll never fix them. And the career criminals, you'll never rehabilitate them either, because they don't want to be rehabilitated.
Yeah.
When they get into a life of crime, they realise that they're going to spend some part of their life in jail. That's just par for the course. They cop it. So when they go to jail, they just use their time to build up some more networks, refine their skills, get some tips, and they're out again. Even when they're out, they know they're going to go back. But it just doesn't bother them.
How do you survive out in the world? I mean, I remember, and you would have spoken to returned servicemen, when you talk to a bloke about his coming home from Afghanistan and he says, "Oh, it's bizarre. I'm driving around suburban Brisbane looking for IEDs," and it just takes a really long time to be able to cope with boring old life again. How do those guys cope with that, with their wives and families and the bloke at the shop?
Are we talking about guards or criminals?
Both, I suppose. When you're spending so much time in an environment like Goulburn, which sounds like hell, then how do you ever cope with the normal world again when someone cuts you off in traffic or,
Yeah, I guess for the prison officers, it's extremely difficult. And I know it is. A lot of the retired guys, actually miss their job. They really love it.
Wow.
And I guess there is a bit of boredom there for a lot of them.
I suppose it'd be never dull. Yes, never dull.
And the inmates, well, they don't have to worry about it for too long because most of them find themselves back in jail within a year.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the weaponry. I mean, how do they make them? Shivs. Apparently, during the Killing Fields period of time at Goulburn, you write in the book, everyone had a shiv of some description, some stabbing implement. Where do they come from?
Yeah, look, if you can find anything that can be fashioned into a point, it will become a shiv. So the most popular, and you've seen it in plenty of TV shows and movies, is the toothbrush. Mm. So you grab your plastic toothbrush and scrape it along the wall and you make a point, and that becomes enough to pierce skin and do some damage. But they're very creative. So the mop buckets, you might know the old steel mop buckets. They've got a little steel spindle around where the device connects. They pull them off. It's a little bit of metal. They sharpen that. That's another famous one.
Wow.
In Goulburn, they had construction going on for a while, and their inmates were getting their hands on steel Rio, which, if you know, is brutal stuff.
No.
It's heavy. It's used in concrete. The whole concrete, but it's basically a big spike. So they're using them. They also get, you know, they had bedposts, bed springs at some stage. You know, you can go through history. Anything that can be made into a weapon has, and it's just been once someone's been stabbed with one, they go, okay, we can't have springs in beds anymore. Foam mattresses.
And again, it comes down to these guys have got all day to figure this stuff out and think up things to try out and see if they work, and you've just got to react to them when it works.
Yeah, they do. And, I mean, you could stop every potential object in jar from being made into a weapon. They're still going to get their hands on them. I mean, people smuggle them in. They go to visits and people will bring them in their body and hand them over. And, you know, there's been guys found with power tools, for crying out loud, in their jail cells that they're digging holes with.
That's Australian journalist and author James Phelps. Phelps with a PH. I'm sure you want to Google him and get all of his books about Australian prisons and prisoners. They're brilliant. And clearly James has an insight into what life is really like in Australian prisons. I was talking about James and his books on radio one morning, and a man phoned up to talk about his own experiences in prison as a former inmate. Of course, radio being the beast that it is, I only had a couple of minutes to speak to him then, but I got his number, I called him back, and he agreed to an interview as long as his name was kept out of it. So here's my anonymous friend talking about his life and times in Australian prisons.
Everyone thinks, if I go there, my life's over. Yeah?
Yeah.
But the thing is, no matter what happens, you're going to either want to sit in the corner and cry, which ain't going to make the doors open for you any magically, any sooner, or you can just sit there and say, you know what, stiff shit, I'm just going to turn around and try and enjoy it, make the most of it, and deal with it.
Try and enjoy prison. I've never heard anyone say that before, but how did you end up in jail?
I was a heroin addict.
Yeah. And so committing crimes to feed your addiction?
Yeah.
Yeah. What sort of crimes?
Bit of everything, really. Yeah. Armed robberies, burglaries, thefts, kidnapping.
So how long had you been using by the time you ended up in jail?
First time I went to jail was probably within 2-3 years, because I was working at the start, and then the habit just got worse and worse, and before you know it, I was no longer working and just committing crime 24/7.
When you ended up in jail the first time, was it scary then? And also, I guess you're withdrawing when you first get in there.
Yeah, but I don't know. Everyone says it's hard to withdraw, but for me, it was easier to do it in jail than it is out here. Because in there, you know, there's no chance. Like, on the street, you know, well, if I turn around and go and do something, yeah, like I'm one burglary or one robbery away from having a hit. Whereas in there, like everyone that goes to jail, well, most that go through the magistrate's court, you end up underneath the court where you got no sunlight, no nothing, and you just lay there. Like, I was there for, I think it was 26 days.
Wow.
So, and that was, you don't get sunlight there. The food is, you wouldn't give it to your worst enemy. Mm. But because it was there, my mind dealt with it quicker. Like, I couldn't do it outside, but in there I could.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but because you know there's no chance, or there is a chance if someone comes through with something, but that's pretty rare.
Mm.
So you just, because you know it's not happening, well, for me, I could switch off, and it was still hard, but on the street it was harder because I knew I just had to go do something and I'd feel better.
So after that first time then, was it sort of less scary to you, the idea of going to jail once you'd been through the system once?
No, after that, that's the problem. Jail doesn't hold fears.
Yeah.
Like, the thing here, you know, is the old saying, it's nice to go where everyone knows your name. And once you go to jail once, you meet that many people, you go back and it's not scary. Like, the first time, when the first time they close the doors on you, once you hear, because the doors are very, very loud and it's got a distinct sound. When you hear them close that door, that's when reality sets in. But then, you know, while you're there, oh, I'm going to get out, I'm going to do the right thing, I'm going to this, I'm going to that. You know, within a week or two, you're back with your old mates and it's the same old stuff over and over. Like, before the first time I went to jail, I was more scared about getting caught because I had built jail up in my mind, whereas after I'd been there once, it didn't hold any fears for me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the guy who wrote the book, he reckoned that, oh, there's two kinds of criminals. There's psychopaths and there's career criminals. But obviously, there's many more kinds of criminals. You were an addict, and it was a means to an end to you, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like you wanted to make a career out of criminal stuff, right?
No, well, the thing for me, each time I got out of jail, I'd try to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But the thing was, I could always go, it was roughly, I'd get to about 12 months clean once I was out of jail, but I couldn't get past that. And eventually I'd slip up and it'd be Groundhog Day again. One day I was living a normal life, the next day I was out 24/7 doing whatever I can to use.
Yeah.
And then eventually for me, the thing was that just as I went to jail, I started to get sick of it, thinking my life's just Groundhog Day. It's just the same thing over and over. And it starts to wear you down. Then I went to jail and the thing is, I realised that everyone there is someone I know. And I started to look, and you see people, you know, that are 20, 30 years older, and then you think, you know, is this what I want in 20 years? Again, I got out after that, and I again stuffed up. But then after that, it was the same thing, and I just thought, you know, in jail, I'd always, you know, got my hands on whatever pills or drugs I could in there. And then this time I turned around and said, nah, I'm going to try to do it right. I put my hand up to get put on methadone, which was a mistake, but anyway. So I got put on that. Didn't use my whole sentence, got out, changed straight away to the Suboxone, and I've been out of jail now probably, it's 3 years in December.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel when you crossed that threshold, that 12-month threshold, and then it was 18 months and then it was 2 years out of jail?
But the thing was, I didn't think about it.
Yeah, right.
The thing was, I was always worried I'd stuff up until I could get a job, because I knew if I was sitting at home, it's not going to take long before I get bored and something will happen. I started to work and I just forgot about it. Just over 18 months ago, I met my missus. And of course, you know, you don't know whether to tell them or not. And I told her bits and pieces without going into too much detail. And then, you know, she wasn't dumb. She started checking on the internet and she found out little things. And eventually I told her everything. And so after a while, she knew when I got out, how long it had been since I'd used or this or that, and she brings it up, whereas now I don't think about it.
Mm.
Like, even I'm still on Suboxone now. I go see the doctor once a month. I have to see him once a month for a script. And, you know, he always sits there and they have to ask the normal question, have you thought about using, have you used? I said, the only time I think about heroin now is when you ask me or someone asks me a question about it.
Mm.
Like, for me, it doesn't even cross my mind anymore.
That's a miracle.
And even I read a book, this is a long time ago, but it said that for most people, heroin has a 9-year cycle.
Oh.
I don't know if it's true. You know, the amount of stuff you're reading books, who knows? Yep. Everyone's got their own theory. But I turned around and include, like, if I minus the time that I was in jail, it works out to roughly 9 years.
Wow.
So whether it's true or not is another story, but
yeah,
maybe for me it is true.
So you credit going to jail with helping you clean up in the end?
Yeah.
And turn your life around?
Well, in jail was the only time, you know, that I could stay. Like, I might be able to use in jail, but I couldn't run a habit in there, like using every day, 3 times a day.
Okay.
So I might be able to have something once a week, once a month, whatever. And in the end, there's people that use in jail, but if you use, say, syringes, for example, unless you've got your own, you have to use what I call a St Kilda syringe, which means everyone's been through it. And the thing is, for me, I'd always use, but I don't know, part of me always knew I wouldn't do it forever, and I was always scared of catching any disease.
Yeah.
And thank God that I don't have anything now, but it was because of things like that that you'd see, you know, 8-10 people mulling up the Suboxone, and they'd sit there and one would stick it in their arm, they'd wash it out with water, then the next one. And this would go on for, you know, 8-10 people every single day. And it made me physically sick to see it.
And quite apart from the bloods is the bluntness of a needle by then. I mean, it must have been scarring them up like crazy.
I've seen them use bike pumps, like literally a shaved-down bike pump that you literally have to hold the person's arm, and then someone else stabs them, and I mean stabs them, to get it in.
Wow.
That's the thing. When you're an addict, you know, you don't care.
No. And I would think if ever I was in an environment where I wanted to vague out and not... And sort of take myself out of my surroundings, it would be in prison. Was that your experience? I mean, I know you didn't use as much in prison, but did you want to?
No, at the start, I did. Yeah. But the thing was, the second time I went to jail, I went in with my own syringe. And then I'd use, but I was also taking, like, you know, half the system, if not three quarters of it's on psych medication.
How did you get your syringe in, by the way?
Do you really want to know?
Yeah.
Up your bum.
Did you really? And in the... I thought they, like, gave you naked searches and stuff.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Okay.
You can turn around, you'd be surprised that you can literally put it up there and you can feel it literally suck up into your stomach.
Wow.
Like, you know, think of everything you probably carry in your purse. If it isn't wider than a cigarette pack, I could probably fit it all, and 99% of the jail system can.
Wow.
You take, you know, some jails don't sell lighters. Like, if you're going to smoke drugs, you need lighters. So people hide lighters, knives, phones, you name it.
Phones.
Mm.
And then, sorry, this is gross, but then do you poo it out? You have to wait till it comes out sort of naturally, or are you reaching up there and getting it?
No, you can just push it back out.
Can you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Be surprised. I mean, people,
I am.
You put someone in an environment where they have to work out with ways to do things. Like, I know people that say to get their medication out, they can, because you have to open your mouth to show them, they can turn around, open their mouth, like first put a piece of Glad wrap in there, roll it up into a ball, swallow it, then they check your mouth, show them there's nothing there, then turn around, cough it back up, unwrap it with their tongue, then they give you the Suboxone, which at the time was in a powder, make sure it goes onto the Glad wrap, show it again to show them you've actually got it in your mouth, and you go into a little room where a guard's watching you, and they turn around and be able to wrap it up, half swallow it again, then they check your mouth afterwards because you've got to have a drink of water, then get back to the unit and just, and bang, it's there. No saliva to it, no nothing.
Wow. And then what are you doing? Are you selling it or something? Do other prisoners want that?
Yeah, now because they give it to you in this like film now, but more often the most used drug in heroin now is Suboxone.
Oh, wow.
Like methadone is a fluid, which is harder. Suboxone was powder, which was easy. So now it's like little, I don't know, it's like an LSD tab that dissolves underneath your tongue.
And so it's a drug to try and help you not...
The heroin withdrawal.
So then why are you saving it? If you have enough of it, do you get high off it?
No, for people that aren't on it, they get high. Like, say, I'm on Suboxone now.
Okay, yeah.
I have it. It just makes me feel normal. You have it, a tiny bit of it, you'll be off your face.
Oh, I see.
Right. See, obviously, it builds up in your system over a while, and for me, it does nothing. Just, if anything, now I feel normal on it. I don't withdraw, I don't nothing.
But all of that stuff—all of that stuff's currency in jail.
Yeah, everything's currency in jail.
Yeah. How did you go finding employment? By the way, you were saying earlier that you knew that was going to be a big part of your staying clean and staying out. How hard is it to do that?
Pretty hard.
When you've been to jail, yeah.
You know, you get people that don't, but then I've noticed these days it's becoming more common that they check. And, like, at the moment, I put an ad up on Gumtree.
Oh.
And I get work through that. But I've also joined in a labour hire agency.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get me work most of the time. And when they don't, I just go onto Gumtree, or I have people ringing the ad I have up every day, and I can just turn around and get a few days' work here and there from that. You know, most weeks now I work, say, at least 4 days. Hopefully, I try work 7 days, but sometimes it's not possible.
Wow. Yeah, so you have, obviously, you have no long-term employment yet, no benefits, no holiday pay, no nothing. You're just, if you don't work, you don't earn.
Yeah.
Wow. And does your partner work?
Yeah, but she can only work 20 hours a week. She's an international student.
So it never gets easier, does it? You're a person who's overcome your addiction and overcome your criminal lifestyle that went with it, but it's really hard for you to be accepted back into mainstream society.
Yeah, well, you've got to see, when you go for a job interview and they find out you have a criminal record, like, I've had people look at me like I raped their daughter or something. Mm. So, you know, I'll try to say, look, all right, I can't hide it. My past is my past. It doesn't mean it's the present and the future.
Mm.
But for some people, it's built up in their head that you're a monster. And I've tried to say to them, look, half the time, mate, I'd steal shit. I'd try most of the time not to hurt anyone. You know, I might steal something and that hurts them in one way, but I'd try not to, you know, I never believed in seeing someone walking down the street and sticking a knife in their throat and saying, give me your wallet or give me your purse.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I thought that was taking it a step too far. But, you know, that's what people put everything together. Yeah, look. They lump you in with rapers, with pedophiles, with murderers, with this, with that.
Yeah.
To them, a criminal's a criminal. I can't say if I never got on drugs if I would have been a criminal, but for me, I know the drugs played a big, big part.
Yeah.
Yeah, before that, I was a bit of a stuff-up, would do dumb things, but not to the extent I went to once I got hooked on drugs.
Yeah. And what was your childhood like, and what was your family like?
Oh, I come from a big, big family. I've got 7 brothers and sisters. But my parents, you know, they get up, go to work every day. I don't blame my parents. You know, people try to say, well, you know, it must have been your parents that they've done something to make your life this. My parents tried to do everything they could for me. Even when I started to stuff up, they stood by me. They'd come by and visit every weekend. And but at the end of the day, it's... You know, to me, once you're over 15, you can make your own choices. My parents couldn't turn around and tell me to stop. I was going to do what I was going to do. They just stood by me, hoping that one day I'd, you know, wake up to myself. And, yeah, it took a long, long time, but now they're happy.
Mm. So they used to come and visit you in prison?
Yeah.
What's that like, having your mum come into prison to visit you?
Bad, because you're always worried if they're going to strip search them or something. Like,
can
I
they
told
do
my
that?
Mum,
can they do that to visitors?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You can turn around and say no, but then you can't visit and they can ban you for a year.
Oh.
And I told my mum and dad, if they ever try to do anything like that, turn around, walk out, don't come back. I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, one time, this is years ago, the MAP were trying a new system that sucked the air out of your clothes to see drug particles.
Mm.
And it come back as my mum with cocaine. And my mum was pissing herself laughing, but they turned around and wanted to strip search her. You know, I'm the one that stuffs up. Why should they be punished as well? It's degrading. I've done the wrong thing. I have to go through it, fair enough.
It's pretty hard to think of your mum being strip searched, isn't it? It's really unbearable.
If they had have done it, I would have found the guard who done it and killed him.
Yeah.
You know, do whatever you want to me. I don't care. I deserve it. I'll cop it on the chin. But to then do something to my family, nah, that's taking it a step too far.
How hard is it to stay out of trouble once you're in there? That's the other impression I get, is that you can get in there and it's really hard to stay, keep to yourself and stay clean, and you can end up with other charges and end up in there longer. And is that true?
Oh, it can be. I got charged, this is about 6 years ago, for a fight in there. But a lot of the time, unless it's serious, like if you go to jail for murder, most of the time they're not going to give you more time if it's not more serious than the offence you're in jail for.
Ooh.
Do you get what I mean?
Yep, yep.
So if you go to jail for murder and you get charged for hitting another prisoner, you won't really get more time. They'll give you time in the slot and they'll say, yeah, we're giving you 12 months, but it runs concurrent with your original sentence.
Yeah.
Now, it's a different kettle of fish if you bring drugs into the jail or you hit a guard.
So, yeah. What's the slot?
Solitary confinement.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Did you ever go to the slot?
Yeah.
So what is it like?
Oh, I was in there for 4 months.
4 months?
Yeah.
What is it? Is it dark in there and you don't talk to anyone?
You can talk. You can yell at each other
right
under the doors. And then once you've been in there for a bit, they give you a run out with one other person that they have to approve.
Okay.
But it's literally just a cell with a bed, a toilet, that's it. You can get, you know, books to read, but you got nothing else to fill your time.
Wow. What about sexual assault? I know the first time we spoke, you said that everyone always thinks, I'm going to go to jail, I'm going to get raped, but you don't think that's sort of necessarily the case. Does it happen, though? Is that a media beat-up?
It's more media. It happens rarely, but the sad thing is most of the people in there that it happens to want it. Like, they're doing it because they're scared. They think if they get some big bloke doing them a few favours, they'll get looked after.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, I know of instances where a rapist came into the jail and, you know, five or six blokes would do it to him. Not rape him for the purpose of wanting to have sex with him, but to show him what happens to people that do it.
Yeah.
You know, rapists, things like that. You know, we've all got daughters, we've all got mothers. We might be crims, but, you know, something like that, no one stands for.
Well, it's interesting because, again, in the guy who wrote the Goulburn book, he reckoned that crimes against women weren't that big a deal anymore in jail, and he put it down to the larger Muslim community, which I thought sounded really racist, but then I don't know. I've never been to jail, so... I mean,
yeah, but it is a bit true.
Yeah, right.
But we don't have, like in Melbourne, the Muslims aren't, they're becoming a lot, like my brother's locked up now and there's a lot more Muslims in there now than there was when I was going to jail.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there's, like, look, there's blokes in jail that they turned around and their wife was asleep and, you know, they had sex with them, they get charged for rape and, look, a lot of the time, I know you're a woman and it might sound bad, but you'd be surprised how many times women use rape charges to get at a bloke.
Okay.
It's sickening, but, you know, it's probably only 1%, which is bad because of, you know, the other 99% that have to go through something as bad as that.
Yeah.
But you'd be, you know, when there's a child involved and they want to get custody, things can get very, very nasty.
Mm.
Like, I know people, they got charged, they got pissed one night and they got a hooker. And at the end, they decided the hooker wasn't good enough. They didn't want to pay her. Well, they got charged for rape.
Mm.
But now, most of the time, like, you do something to a kid, you pretty much go to protection straight away or you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
You will get terrorised, which I think is fair.
Mm-hmm.
Rape, the same thing, but... I've noticed now it only really happens when it's splashed all over the news and then it's like someone just wants to make a name for themselves.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, you see something on TV, like a few times people say, oh, I'm in for something else, and then you'll be sitting there and on the TV someone's head will pop up with their little cartoon drawings and then you'll realise, wait a second, that's him.
Oh.
And so a lot of the time they try to run out of the union, but occasionally they get caught and...
They literally jump up and run out when their cartoon pops up on the news.
No, once that happens, they know what's going to happen. Because it's one thing because they've done it, but it's also they've sat there and lied about it,
yeah,
which
right.
makes it a whole lot worse.
Are you still in touch with anyone? I remember you saying the other day that there is the communication between the inside and the outside is very very clear. There's no troubles at all with finding out inside what's going on outside, vice versa.
Yeah, I have a couple of people that are on my phone list that are in jail because they changed it a few years ago that you could have mobile. You know, in the end, no one really uses home phones anymore.
Yeah.
You can have one or two mobiles on your phone list. So I've got a couple of mates. One's at Barwon, one's at Darangal, and there's one at Fulham.
Often, probably once a week, maybe. Sometimes once a fortnight.
Okay. Do you ever think about not doing that and about sort of distancing yourself from all of that?
No.
No?
Most of the people now, like, there's people we used to run around with that are still doing what we used to do, and for them, that's when I keep my distance.
Yeah.
Someone's going to come out, try to do the right thing. I know what it's like to have no help, so I'll do my best to help them.
Mm.
But once they start to drift off, that's when I say, see you later.
God, so, I mean, and I mean, this is true of anyone who's, you know, recovering from an addiction. It's just a daily grind, isn't it? I mean, you have to just take every day as it comes and take every person who comes out as they come. And
yeah, but that's the thing. Like, people say, oh, it's a daily thing. But the thing is, for me, it doesn't cross my mind.
Yeah.
It doesn't come into the equation anymore. It did for, say, the first 18 months. And now, like I said, it's only if someone mentions it that I think about it. It's a no-go for me anymore. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, you know, who knows what tomorrow holds, but I can't really see myself doing it. I mean, if I did and my missus found out, she'd probably castrate me in my sleep.
Yeah.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review and 5 stars on iTunes. And if you like reading about true crime, you must read our very own Emily Webb's books, Suburban Nightmare, Murder in Suburbia, and Angels of Death. You can get your hands on those books by hitting the Shop Now button on our Facebook page. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davron, Kieran Simpson, and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together.